What your face looks like, smile, frown, lips all tight and clenched, hands all tight and clenched, that's over half of the communication. And then over a third, 37-38%, is what the voice sounds like. What do my words sound like as they're coming out to you? Do they sound hesitant and fearful? Do they sound angry? There's a story that goes along with this of the guest who was in one of the South American countries. And there, I just started this spring when I give a presentation to a group that I carry along a soapbox. And my soapbox has a lot of different labels on it. But I'll start out using my soapbox. We couldn't fit it into our VW, however, with five people and our camping equipment for the trip up here, so it sits at home in Syracuse. But if you're in South America, so I'm told, I've never been there, on a Sunday afternoon in any of the parks, you'll see people out on their soapboxes giving a sermon on one of their favorite topics. And as this guest was visiting in a South American country with his native friend, they went through the park and they heard this man who was up on a soapbox shaking away and yelling and screaming and just his arms going all over his body, pounding and clenching his fist. And the visitor thought, my heavens, what is going on? What kind of radical is that? And so he asked his native friend, what is this man speaking about? What is he lecturing with all this anger and fire and brimstone? And the native friend listened for a while and said, love. Well, we hardly expect to have somebody that we dearly care about come up and with an angry voice and clenching fist say, I love you. We wouldn't believe him very much, I don't think. Well, tone of voice, what our body looks like, feels like, how it moves, that's 90-some% of how we communicate. And then along come the words. I remember back in high school, which is a long time ago, our band director, who was a marvelous person, drilling into us before any concert or contest, the idea of first what people get through their eyes and then what they get through their ears. As a sense, insane. Really, how your body looks. He was talking about how we looked in our ranks and how we sat with scruffy shoes or hair combed or such, I suppose. But if we translate that to communication and saying, what greets you first before you begin to hear? And then before you hear the words, what are the sounds that come out? All of these things. And I think this must terrify preachers. And how many preachers ministers do we have here in this group tonight? Just a couple? This must terrify ministers if their congregations ever knew that really they worked so hard to get that 8% of the communication out as they wrote their sermons, but really what's important is how they're up there saying it and how they really respond with the pulpit tone or the conversational tone. Okay, so it's the basics of communication. We look at what we see, what we're hearing, just the tone quality, and then the actual words that come through, and then how these three things interact on the other person. What kind of feelings do they produce? What kind of response does it produce? So when adult says to another adult, or adult says to youngster in a certain voice, what you doing now? Or how did that happen? You become primed already by the sound. Maybe they might say, what happened? And that could produce an entirely different response in one. But the other one almost invites you to defend yourself. Or if it doesn't invite you, you're going to feel that you have to in order to survive. So this is, in a sense, how the communication goes out to someone else. How the communication comes in to me is another complicated thing. How do I listen to other people? How do you listen to other people? With one ear and the other one is busy thinking, what's in between the ears thinking of what am I going to say in response or what kind of story can I tell to top this? Do we really listen Do we get the general gist only by looking at the person and the body language and hearing that tone without listening to the words? That would give us a good amount of communication. Do we really tune in to what the other person is saying? Or do we think, do we create certain assumptions that I know what that person is going to say? I don't even have to listen. It's always complaining about something, or it's always telling me something to do. So that we tune off even before we have a chance to hear what those words might be, and you might be surprised sometimes that they could be warm fuzzies, compliments, things that might make you feel good, nice surprises. But how do we listen to others? Do we think of our own answer, our own story to topic? Are we ready to defend ourselves? Do we hear what the other person means, what the other person might feel along with that meaning? Then how do we share this? Somebody said something, someone's heard something. Do they pass each other in a dark street? And someone might say, oh, I know how you feel, or I know what you must be going through, which could be very true, but unless it carries something more with it, you might say, how could anyone know what I'm feeling? How could anyone understand what I'm feeling? And you pass each other and you really don't share the feelings. Sometimes it's too great a risk. Sometimes you think the other person just doesn't care. I'm not very worthwhile. So the whole aspect of risk is an important element in our communication. Are we willing to risk? What about the feelings? Remember I said what you hear triggers certain feelings within you. And are we capable of dealing with these feelings? Have we had so many negative experiences that we sort of turn off certain things, or we automatically push a certain button for a certain kind of response when we see a certain person? And that triggers certain other responses that means that we can't really share. We're too afraid to risk, or it's too threatening. And how do we feel about our feelings? Are they okay? Feelings aren't right or wrong. Feelings are. And that's awfully hard to accept. I find it difficult to accept sometimes. I want to say, no, I really shouldn't feel that way, and I negate my own feeling. And yet we are what we feel. We feel what we are. Many times people will get into difficulty with feelings as being acceptable, because look at all the things that feelings can produce. But that's another part of it. First is the acceptance that you have these feelings, whatever they happen to be, good, bad. Often we think of the bad feelings, if we can even use that term, as being the only kind of feelings we have. We forget that we can have feelings of joy. And they probably don't happen quite as often. Feelings are. It's when we put certain feelings into action for any particular reason that we come into a difficult situation. When are these feelings, when they're put into action, going to be destructive or constructive? That's another big area of discussion. Often if feelings are accepted for what they are, they will be somewhat, if they're very negative, if they're very strong, hostile, they'll be diffused so that they won't go into negative action, they won't go into destructive action. And how do you feel when you're in a problem kind of situation? Well, we can look at going through the basic information from parent effectiveness training or teacher effectiveness training. There are two books in the library, and also one is in the bookstore. The one in the bookstore is a Christian perspective on parent effectiveness training, and we'll take some things from that this evening. It's You Can Have a Family Where Everybody Wins, and I think the price is $1.95, and it's available in the bookstore. It's also available in the library. The second, and I'm not used to seeing it without its paper cover, and I find it's awfully drab and dull without it. It's just parent effectiveness training. They have a new one out that's called teacher effectiveness training, and if you're a teacher, I think it's a one of the best things that's happened in recent years for teachers. This is in the library. That's available. But when we look at these feelings and we look at things that happen, we have to begin to deal with how these feelings, how they're interacting within us. And we often look at behaviors caused, which produce certain feelings. And Tom Gordon in Parent Effectiveness Training and Teacher Effectiveness Training talks about the window through which we look at all behaviors. And I won't limit this to just parents looking at the behaviors of their children, but children looking at the behaviors of their parents, adults looking at behaviors of adults, kids looking at behaviors of kids. This knows no age boundary. As I understand it, Effectiveness Training Associates out of Pasadena, which I've developed under which Tom Gordon promotes his books, is writing one. Another one is called Youth Effectiveness Training, YET. He's also got another one in the works called Couple Effectiveness Training for marriage enrichment. And one on Christian Effectiveness Training, which is the program that was begun through the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and the parochial school system, which is really quite good. If we look through this window and we look at the behaviors of the other person, let's just talk about the other person, me and the other person. And there'll be certain behaviors. There are certain behaviors that don't cause me any problems. It may be a problem that the other person has. They're sad about something. Somebody has said something to them. Something didn't work out right. They may come. They may have a particular problem that's not really bothering me, but it may be a problem that's bothering someone else. So we can put down at the top that the other owns a problem. Okay, you can think of certain behaviors. Someone might say, gum chewing doesn't bother me, but it might bother someone else. So we get into different categories of where does the problem lie. A youngster may come home from school and say, "Boy, was Mr. So-and-so a lousy teacher today? Or did Timbuktu down the street really kick me in the shin? Or he threw my coat into the mud puddle?" Or certain kinds of things where they're obviously bothered about something. You're on the outside. That behavior hasn't happened to you. Somebody didn't kick you in the shins. You didn't have to go through the bad day with this particular teacher. Or the boss, or whatever it happens to be. So that I can't say in the situation, I own that problem. It happened to someone else. So I can say that that's when the other person owns the problem, and then we deal with it in a certain way. We come to the point where I own a particular problem, and I'm delighted to be at Holden Village because one of the problems that I own very strongly is being in the smoke-filled room. And so I have a problem when other people are smoking. It gives me a runny nose. The next day I'll sneeze and I'll have a runny nose and my eyes will run and I'll be like a full-blown cold because I've sat in somebody else's smoke for several hours. It may not, and it certainly didn't bother the person that was smoking, or they probably wouldn't be smoking. So I, in that situation, have to say that I own the problem. Hopefully days are pretty good so that there's a space in between here where no one owns the problem. It's problem free. That's pretty nice. Tom Gordon says in Teacher Effectiveness Training that that's the only place where learning can take place. And I shuddered when I read that because I wonder if any learning or any teaching ever takes place then, because there's always bound to be somebody who's got a problem one place or the other. But when you're free, when you don't have to defend yourself, when you don't have to really have to deal with great feelings, unmet needs, you're not going to be able to teach or to learn quite as well. So this is the kind of goal that we all head for. And we hope that the days are where this line goes up, this whole inner area, and maybe there's only a very small amount at either the top or the bottom where there are problem areas. Tomorrow we'll deal with a section where these two come out and we both own the problem. Often we automatically shift into that position and we say, well, I own that problem too. I've got to help my child get back in good steads with a friend who's just said something to them down the street, called them a name. And so we rush quickly into that battle. And it would be much better for us to stay out and head back in and let the problem be owned by the other person and let them have that beginning experience at learning how to deal. There are times, and perhaps the school is one of the times where you need to know the other child, the person who owns the problem, and how much that person is able to deal with it. Sometimes they do need help. But we don't perhaps get fully into the both owning the problem at that point. Okay, how do we decide who owns the problem? And when somebody does have a problem, what do we do about it? Well, that's the whole great job of communication. And one of the things that comes in very important is this, is as we deal with the communication and dealing with these problems, is a little sign that we all wear, whether we know it or not. And it's a sign that says, I am lovable and capable. As children of God, we're lovable and capable whether we believe it or not. And most of the time we don't. And there are times we go up and down on this scale of acceptance of ourselves. And that certainly influences to a great extent how we're going to deal with the whole problem situation. There is the little booklet that's put out by Argus Communications on I Am Lovable and Capable, and its subtitle is A Modern Allegory on the Classical Put-Down. And I think particularly people involved in school and people involved in home, whether they're parents or teens, would find this fairly interesting, and how to deal with the kinds of things that make us not believe the sign that we do wear. It's interesting to see all the sweatshirts that have messages on now, whether they happen to be names or as we walked in, the sweatshirt that says, I feel like I'm an unlisted phone, I have an unlisted number in the book of life. Sometimes we wear a lot of sweatshirts with labels on that we aren't aware that we wear them. Sometimes they're very visible and we can believe them or not believe them, and other times we have certain labels on the back of our shirts or sweatshirts or whatever it happens to be that might read kick me or pity me or whatever else that we happen to feel, and through our nonverbal communication perhaps shout very loudly. Well, how we feel about ourselves certainly has a strong bearing on how we're going to deal with the problems and how we decide what these problems are, and as we deal with problem ownership. Well, let's go into this first one, and I realize I should have had some tips. Maybe these are owned. Hold up. Okay. When the other person owns the problem, we have some things that we can do with that. And Gordon calls the one manner of dealing with the situation with communication when the other person owns a problem as using active listening. Well, that's a technical term for Tom Gordon. We can call it, in a sense, feedback. How are we going to communicate to the other person that we have indeed heard what it is that they've said? What are we hearing them saying? Feedback can be our way of responding to what we hear, the words that we're hearing them say, and the feelings that we're seeing them have, as well as hearing them have. It might be the feeling of having been just put down by somebody that you care for greatly. It could be a feeling of somebody having greater expectations for you than you feel that you can come through with. How does that teacher ever expect us to get through all of this stuff in one night? Why didn't she tell us about it 3 weeks ago? It's 4 weeks' work, and she gives us overnight to do it. Okay, that's a situation where the speaker owns that particular problem. We could come in here, I suppose, and say, I'll help you with it all. What do you need writing here? I'll sit down and type it for you. And well, I'm sure a lot of teenagers might like that and get out of some of that particular work, but it may not be the greatest benefit in the long run. So how do we respond to that? How do we approach what we're hearing and what we're hearing, seeing of the feelings? Is it a downcast kind of look? And what would happen if in a situation we started saying, well, you get to it right now? How does that feed back the content or the feelings? If you were the one that owned the problem. Let's get a problem that's even closer. There's this long line after Vespers every night going into the snack bar. And sometimes the line starts to form long before the snack bar is ready to open, so you stand 1 foot, and then you stand on the next foot, and the line moves and it curves around and it changes places because you get tired of just standing in one place, and you go to talk to somebody else, and the line moves and people come around. Someone says, the line doesn't, the end of the line is back there. You're really way into the line. Somebody new has come in. And you're overhearing this as a kind of conversation. And you're in conversation perhaps with the person who has said this, who's really hungry. They were out fishing and they didn't have supper. They came back after the supper was finished and they're really waiting for that snack bar to open to have one of these big hot fresh sundaes. And so they're really very hungry. They have a problem. They want to eat, but they don't want anybody else. They don't want this line to get longer ahead of them because they've been waiting there. So somebody could respond by saying, well, you're a Christian. Give up your space in line. How would you feel about that? If you were the person waiting in line, and somebody gives you a kind of order, oh, don't be such a stick in the mud, let me get in ahead of you. Or what if somebody said, oh, you're very kind and helpful and gracious and courteous tonight, you're going to let me get in ahead of you and the six people that are with me? You're not going to be that fussy. How would you feel about that? If you were the person with your stomach growling, waiting to get in. Does that make you feel very good? Someone said, well, that's your Christian duty. Let other people get in ahead of you. Now, if you've been waiting here so long, you can just wait a little bit longer and be kind enough to let other people in. Giving a kind of evaluation, giving you some little lecturing about not being so legalistic about it all. How'd you feel about that? Did you stand there with your stomach growling? What if somebody said to you, what's the matter with you? Didn't have enough to eat today? Does that make you feel very good? Questioning what's wrong with you at this particular point? We use a lot of questions in our conversation with people. What if someone said, oh, you're too fat anyway, you don't need to have anything that's in this snack bar, so get out of the way, you don't need to eat today. It's a pretty strong put-down, isn't it? You might be ready to haul off and sock him at about that time. Well, these are examples of what Tom Gordon calls roadblocks to communication, the kinds of things that make you less than willing to listen to the other person's problem, and certainly not very helpful in solving the other person's problem, helping the other person to resolve his problem. So we come back again to when the other person owns a problem, how do we feed back the content of feelings? So I'm the person that's come up to the line not knowing where the end of the line is, and thinking it's the end over here, and that's the guy who's really got this growling stomach and who's just drooling for that hot fudge sundae and some cherries, and informs me that that's not the end of the line. I might say a variety of things. I might give him one of the roadblocks, and Gordon talks about the dirty dozen, the 12 handicaps to continuing conversation. I might try to figure out what it is that he's saying, and it might come through clear enough that, oh, I didn't realize this was the end of the line, and I could give a purely factual kind of response. That perhaps does not, we can go into the content and feelings of, I guess you've really waited a long while and it doesn't feel very good to have somebody come in ahead of you. And a fellow or a girl or a person, human, who's got hungry, could then, hearing my statement, my feedback to him, either clarify or verify that what I did hear was indeed what he meant for me to hear. Yes, this is not the end of the line, it's the beginning, and we've waited a long while. And I'd be glad to tell you where the end of the line is, if you're interested. Okay, that's the illustration gets us off into a dead end, in a sense. But how do we deal with a situation when somebody has some strong feelings? And one of the problems that comes in about this point is to start, and as we look at ownership of whether I own the problem or the other person owns the problem, is that we put everything into a problem category. And my favorite illustration on this is when somebody comes up to me and says, where is the restroom? And do I quickly say, oh, that person's got a problem, and I say, well, you really need to go very quickly, don't you? Or do I say this as a point of information, it's down the hall and to the left or the right? You know, there's a time at which we give strictly the information that they're asking for. There are other times as you feel the content and the feelings of the message can decide that that is a particular problem. The questions that come from teens to their parents about the use of the car or about what time they may come in at, what time they're coming in at night or the schedule for the week. Sometimes these are problems that are owned by the teenager. Sometimes they're the problems that are owned by the parent. Sometimes they're the problems that are owned by both. Situations on when the other person owns the problem and how we listen to them is when there's a very strong feeling about some joy that they have. Wow, our report cards just came through. What kind of message is that kind of statement getting across? You didn't do very well today, this term? Would that be reading the situation? I come in all excited? Okay, what might be tuned in? Gee, you really feel great. Sounds like it's good news. That seemed to, would you verify it or clarify it? Mom comes home from work. There are those situations now. More and more of them. And the teenagers are, the children are home. And Mom may come in and say, wow, I wish I had a job that was closer so I wouldn't have to drive through all that traffic. I started out 45 minutes ago and it should have only taken me 15 minutes. Would you as a teenager say, gee, you really like to drive, don't you? Is that getting back at the message that you're hearing? Is that very accurate? No, what might you say? Who would like to give it a try? What did you hear in that kind of statement?
She needs some support. That's too bad, Mom. I really feel for her. I really feel for her.
Boy, that's too bad, Mom. I really feel for you. That's where the tone of the voice would come in. It could be a very kind comment, or it could be a real put-down just to add to the traffic. Okay?
You must be really tired. Would you like me to start supper for you?
Oh, I don't know if it's wishful thinking. I think that sounds like a great idea. I'm going to give you some help. Okay, and you might end up having, if both working together, whether the teenager ended up doing the whole meal or not, well, the mother could respond back, you, I don't want you in the kitchen. You end up leaving a dirtier mess than it is now, and you'll be more bothered. I've had enough problems today. Go. Well, that's the kind of thing that doesn't really help in the communication. We put certain assumptions on things. And I forget who is it that says the path to hell is paved with false assumptions. And we often do this. We assume that the person is going to put me down. We assume that there's not going to be help from the person. We assume that it's going to be worse if the person helped than if they didn't. And so we negate the other person as a human being with potential, and we put them down until they really agree on that particular reading. And then we wonder along the way how we as adults, or our children at whatever ages they are, or our friends at whatever ages they are, respond and act in the way they do. And without realizing that much of this is certainly unintentionally done throughout our existence, whether it's with our peers, whether it's with the school, whether it's in the home, whether it's in your working situation, we all come to have certain expectations and certain feelings about ourselves, of whether we're capable or incapable people. And we sort of live these out. I think it's Dreikers that says, expect the person to already be what you would like them to be, and they'll soon become that model. Often we come in with such very negative expectations that there's really nothing to reach, and the person begins to realize that there's not much that they can do very well, so they never try to reach anywhere. We assume as teenagers that our parents are always going to say no, irregardless of what the question is. So we come in right away fighting, determined that we're going to have one-upmanship, and we end up with a worse relationship, or either a stronger no, or I don't care, I can't do anything with you, which might be satisfactory because you've at least won. But then we've really lost sight of a kind of goal where we can have a family where everybody wins. And we don't have to deal with situations at the expense of someone else. Okay, so feedback is where we try to listen to what the other person who owns a problem is saying with their feelings and with the words. And then to send that back with our own rephrasing. Not like a parrot. You know what a parrot says? You say, Polly wants a cracker, and the parrot says, Polly wants a cracker back. So if somebody says, boy, nobody's listening to me today. And you say, nobody's listening to you today. And the first person says, every time I try to say something, they walk off And you say, every time you try to say something, people just walk off. And the first person says, nobody cares about what I think. And you say back, nobody cares about what you think. They're going to walk off. And that hasn't helped either situation. So parroting, which often seems like the simplest thing to do, where you just repeat back what you've heard, often loses conversation too. If it's done once or so, I'm sure that we'll all, it'll be much more acceptable than being put down or yelled at or walked away from, a little bit better. But how do we really listen to the other person so that we can tune in to what they're saying, and as it goes through our hearing and our feelings, can come back out with our interpretation of the words? It has the advantage, rather than saying, I understand, and how do I know that what you understand is what I really mean for you to understand? It gives me an opportunity as a person who owns a problem to be able to clarify it or verify, yes, that's right, that is what I meant to say, and furthermore, go on, or no, that's not what I meant to say, I really mean, and then go on and try again. In different words. There's another great benefit from this, and that's that it helps the person who owns a problem to have a chance to really hear what they indeed themselves are feeling. Sometimes we just keep feeling right along and we don't even listen to ourselves as we're trying to deal with our own feelings. And to hear somebody else put it into a different perspective gives us a new idea of what we ourselves are feeling and can often help us then to figure out, aha, I didn't really look at it that way myself, and that gives me an idea. We're not giving them answers. We're not solving the problem for them. We're saying that I trust you. I believe that you do have the capability of resolving your conflict, dealing with your problem. I'll listen, and I accept that you do have these feelings. Often we ourselves are dealing with the feelings rather ambiguously, and we're not exactly sure how we feel about them. And if we're really concerned and bothered by something and you're worrying and somebody says to you, stop worrying, you don't have to worry, there's nothing to worry about. The next question, as you give this, you ought to also ask yourself the question, when was the last time somebody told you to stop worrying and you did? So that negating another person's feelings or saying that they don't should not have these feelings as a means of solving their problem really do not help the situation. We can also think of how would you like to have others treat you if you had a problem to deal with? Can you put yourself in the other's shoes and see how it feels? Often, when somebody has a problem that we may have experienced, we'll say, aha, if we're not feeling very good about ourselves, we'll say, aha, they can experience what I had to experience, and so you kind of pay them back. You push a button that says payback, and that button sets up all sorts of things, and you do to the other person what somebody else did to you. You're trying to explain something serious to another person, and they start to laugh at you. So, and you feel humiliated by this. You're telling a serious story and they say, oh, you could believe something like that. You're the stupidest. You're really gullible to be put down by this. So somebody else starts to tell you something very serious and you say, I remember when so-and-so, and you say, oh, you're the stupidest thing. How could you be so gullible? You know, without listening to the other person, because you've been carrying that load from someone else and you've got to find someone to dump it on. So, These are non-productive ways of helping the other person to deal with that particular problem. What are we hearing the other person saying? How can we say it? What you sound like, or I hear you saying, or wow, it's really been that we can rephrase what we've heard to the other person so that it is understood. For the person that has the problem, we can look, if it's one that you would normally label as angry, we need to then look at it and deal with anger as always a secondary response. It's a response to some other feeling. And until we find out what that main feeling is, then it's going to be difficult to deal with the anger. So if you're angry and you feel like really kicking someone or putting someone down or tearing someone down because they've torn you down, to really feel why, was that, how, what's causing this anger in me that's producing my problem? Is it because I feel that I've been put down? I feel I've been misjudged? I feel I have been misunderstood? I have been negated as a person? And when we can begin to identify why we're having this particular feeling about some issue, then we can begin to put it in proper perspective and begin to deal with it without paying back. Okay, when the other person happens to own the problem, that's a different situation. I own the problem. I'm in a situation where I'm bothered by something. I'm bothered by the smoke. I'm bothered by the noise. I'm bothered because somebody's not understanding me. It's not bothering the other person. They think they understand me. They think they have a right to make the noise, to smoke, or whatever the situation happens to be. So I clearly own the problem. How do I deal with that? Do I say, you inconsiderate person, don't you know what you're doing? Do I put the load on them? Do I label them? Or can I, at this point, begin to own my own feelings? Can I admit, I have this feeling? I'm bothered. I'm upset. The irritation, the noise, the whatever has been translated in through me and through my system of expectations and values and whatever. And it's produced a kind of feeling that's raising a red flag somewhere within me. If I dump that particular load on the other person, that's going to raise some additional feelings. First of all, I still have to deal with my own because I own them. But now I have to deal with the other person because I've given them something to have to deal with too. So instead of having to deal with two things, let's just stop at the first and deal with your own and not put the load on the other person. So I own the problem. I have to find some way of saying that this is how I feel. I have to find some way to put my confrontation into words that will not require the other person to defend himself. So, as a teenager, I lived on a farm in southern Minnesota, and the school was 7 miles away. And when something had to go on, something was going on in school that I wanted to go to, it wasn't something I could just walk down the street for or catch a bus. I had to find some way of getting there. And so I would own some problems. And for most of our time, we were a one-car family on the farm. And then we got an old pickup, which they said I could use because nothing worse could happen to it than already did. But there were times that that didn't work, and I would own a problem. And I couldn't say, you stupid people, why do we have two cars that don't work? Or how come I always say, why don't you live closer to town? Why don't, you know, I could set up a lot of things that could have been very mean and cruel and hateful about why we lived out on this farm. I really didn't mind it. But there were times it was inconvenient. I had to instead, I didn't know it at the time, and I probably didn't do it, but as an illustration to have said, you know, I have a need to get into such and such a meeting. And I hope I would be able to say it far enough ahead of time so that there could be some planning done. And if it turned out to be that it caused a problem with the other person, that we would have some time to work on method three or problem solving. But to be able to say that I own the particular problem, that I have a particular need, means that I have to begin to use the word I instead of you. When I use the word you, I'm really putting the problem on you. I'm either labeling you or I'm saying you're responsible for it. But we have to be responsible for our own feelings and for our own needs. And so to say you is a one-way path down a dead-end street. It's not helpful, it's not solving the problem, it's not going to improve the relationship or enhance the relationship. It's going to make people more upset or difficult to deal with. I have to find a way of saying how your particular behavior is affecting me. And you may be very unaware of how your behavior has an effect on me. So I have to find a way of saying that as I use I to be able to state my feelings, state what my values are, and boy, that's a good question to deal with. How many of us really know very clearly what we do value? Could we write down in 10 minutes a statement of 10 very important things that we value? That's an exercise that would be valuable if we had more time to deal with that clock. Where is it? No. Okay. What are our expectations? Do I expect quiet, absolute quiet each time I come into the house? Do I expect absolute perfection of the other people with whom my life is involved? Do I expect other people to know what my feelings are before I have an opportunity, or before I clearly know what they are myself and have a chance to express them? So here we come back to assumptions again. Sometimes we feel that the other person ought to know, just intuitively know, how I'm going to feel in a certain situation, and therefore change their behavior. But that's another one-way ticket down a one-way street, or a dead-end street. How can we state what my value is? How can I state what my value is? How can I state what my expectations or my feelings are in the particular situation in which I own the problem, in which I'm bothered? For both parents and for all members of a family, I feel this is very, very important. How do we communicate the feelings? And we really haven't had much experience in most families. We have not had much experience in doing this. We're sort of quiet about what our feelings are. We think the other person, it's not important to the other person, or it really wouldn't help the situation. Why bother? It's just better to be quiet and not say anything, and then you can't be blamed for anything. And then if the expectations aren't met or something isn't done, then, you know, we have to go back and figure out what was missing. And most often it's a clear understanding of where our expectations were, understanding of how we actually feel about a certain thing. How can I express my feelings? Not only in problem situations, that's the very most difficult, but how do we even express our feelings when there's no problem, when we're in this area? Both for kids and parents, for spouses, to really think, when was the last time I really said to someone that I care very much about, in the family or even outside the family, a strong positive I statement? I value you, I appreciate you, I love you, I enjoy being with you. That's the kind of thing that for some reason is very threatening and very risky. Perhaps because we feel maybe they're not going to say that back to me. And then here I've sort of opened myself up and I'm empty and we can add all sorts of things in there that sort of hamper us from doing it. And so we so often forget the I, and we instead say, you ought to be more thoughtful. You ought to know what I mean. You ought to, and you can fill in the blanks with all your favorite phrases. I'm sure we have a lot of them. I find myself with quite a few that I would wish I did not have. Some these are some basic things in this very first beginning. Now, I hate to stop at this point with such a quick overview. I think I will to get some questions. For those of you who are not familiar with Parent Effectiveness Training Program, it's a 24-hour series. It's 8 sessions of 3 hours each. So to think in 1 hour you can get into a good handling of it, it's rather facetious in a way. I think it can begin us to think, however, where we are and where it is that we might want to go. And the fact that we have different age levels listening to this who may be part of the same family, that each of you has heard something that the other person has heard, and you can then continue on in your own further conversation of this, of how did you feel about this? What did you think of when? How might we begin to deal with some of these things? How can we feel more comfortable about saying, I feel, or I'm feeling, to be able to deal with what's inside each one of us? How can we begin to listen more carefully to what the other person is saying, putting aside some of our strong feelings on the issue until we can begin to fully understand what the other person is feeling? And you'll find that conflicts which go way up to here will begin to simmer out a little bit and level out a little bit to a lower level, and depending upon how you work at it, to a much more pleasant existence. I think it's also important to realize that it's okay when we're dealing with problems, if we've jumped into a situation, whether the other person owns a problem or if I own it, and I jump in with 3 feet kicking and screaming into a situation, and then all of a sudden realize, why in the world am I doing this? That's not helping it. To be able to say, let's start all over again. My feelings really got away with me, and I'm not dealing with it very well, but let's try again. What I want to say is, how I'm feeling is. You can always back up. You can always try again. There's no just 3 outs, 3 strikes and you're out in this, when we're really trying. And to think, oh, how in the world am I going to deal 26 hours a day, 8 days a week with this kind of thing? I won't have any time to do anything else. I feel that if we can begin to change 3 situations, 1 situation a day, in which I would normally really blow out the other person, really scream at the other person, put them down, demand and command and do any of the 12 put-downs that Gordon talks about. If I can eliminate one of them, it means there's 1 less time that the other person is hurt. And maybe after a couple weeks you can eliminate 2 of them. That communication will never reach perfection, but it's always a goal toward which we can work. And if we stop by saying, oh, I could never do that anyway, so why try? We've lost a lot before we've even begun. And it means perhaps we don't feel that comfortable and capable about ourselves, and we need some support. And maybe that's where somebody else can come in from our family and say, well, let's give it another old college try. Let's see if we can do it. And we do need the encouragement. It's okay to say, I'm sorry. It's okay to say, I made a mistake. And it's okay to even say, gee, I don't really know, but let's try to find out. Otherwise, it's very difficult for somebody else to learn to say some of those same things. Okay, let's have some questions. That's a lot of content. It's not been a very experiential kind of thing. Let's deal with some of the feelings that you may have from what you've heard.
When you talk about your own feelings, are you saying that the other person is interested in what you're, that you should explain what you're feeling, or just to the other person, or just know your own feelings, admit that you've got your feelings?
if the feelings involved are produced by another person, then it's helpful if you want that person's behavior to change. If somebody's pounding away at the piano and you've come in with a splitting headache and it's feeling worse and you're in another room and you're saying, I'm not going to let it bother me, I'm not going to let it bother me, I'm not going to let it bother me. When you come out, you're not going to be feeling very happy and accepting and open to anyone in the household. If you can say, that noise is really making my headache worse, to yourself, and say, it's my headache, and it's the way I'm hearing the noise that's making me feel bad, and maybe begin to change the words around to say, I have a very bad headache, and I'm finding that the noise is making it even worse, and I'm not able to live with myself, or however you happen to feel. Sharing that with the other person might help the other person realize, I can do this another time. If you're beginning to build that kind of a relationship, it may not happen the first time. They might say, oh, you've always got a headache.
It's better than saying, stop playing that piano.
You stupid, inconsiderate, and nincompoop.
Yeah.
Where would you go from there? That would say, if they don't.
If they don't stop,
stupid.
Well, let's save that for a little farther down. If you throw the whole load at them right away, what are you going to come up with next? Maybe they didn't hear. I'm not sure you heard what I just said, and I really feel. I feel lousy, I feel awful, I feel like I'm not going to be fit to live with if I keep hearing that music, and if I get to that point, it'd be better that you and the piano aren't around. Maybe that might get through a little bit. Would it?
Sometimes, can't we come to a little bit to a standstill, because both parties have feelings. You know, the other one in this example might have feelings of just needing to be kind of surrounded by loud music. I mean, you know, just absorbed in that. And could, if they beat the other one to the punch, could say, I'm feeling the need to have this music loud. The other one has a headache. Sometimes don't. It's a fine line where you just have to decide you have a problem and then I'll do something about it myself without insisting the other person alter their behavior, like I'll go into another room or I'll
go for a walk down the
street. Maybe I go outside or something. You know,
but there may be at times, for instance, if the piano is going and the other person is really trying to get through a hard piece because they have a piano lesson 10 minutes from now and they haven't learned this and they've got to get it through and they've got to keep at it. There may be a real need on the other person's say, but I've got to finish this kind of thing. And you may have to do some quick problem solving, or maybe the first person says, well, I realize you've got a need and I've got a need, and it might be easier for me to go where the piano isn't than for you to move the piano somewhere else. Or I can manage 10 more minutes of this. Or promise me it's only 10, well,
yeah.
I say, 10 minutes I think I can manage, or 10 minutes I'm going to go put my head under the pillow or down in the basement or whatever.
Yeah.
That there might be some mediation that can go on very quickly. I would hope that in a household where maybe there has not been very good communication, if there can, I don't think you can spring this, and this is why I really like to have sessions with parents and kids. That it's not the parents who are beginning to use a strange new method on kids in a kind of manipulative fashion, but that this is one way where both of us can work more meaningfully and lovingly and understandingly together. And if I'm dealing with just adults, I'll say, don't go home and try this on your kids, in just twisting it in, because they'll say, hey, you're going to a class. It's a stupid thing to do. That's not going to work on me. Don't even bother trying it. But to say, look, we haven't really been very, if this is the situation in your household, that we've not really been able to communicate very well together, and you're not happy about it, and I'm not happy about it, and we don't, you haven't liked my screaming at you, and I haven't liked your screaming back at me, or your defiance, or whatever of me, what else can we do? How can we try something else? We've got a lot of problems to work out together. Let's see how we can deal with these. Because there's more than one way of dealing with the problem. Anyone who limits a manner of dealing with a problem as an adult to a child by either just screaming, name-calling, or spanking hasn't realized that there's a whole wide world out in front of other possibilities that are much more healthy and positive.
I can see where, you know, thinking of this just with my own particular thing, I can see where I would maybe tend to make, when, like, a child of mine has a problem, and maybe I have a problem about something else entirely, and the child owns the problem, you know, but I find myself reacting to it and drawing myself into it so that we both own the problem, when that shouldn't have happened, and that's not helping him at all.
And if you realize that, to be able to say, wow, I'm trying to solve this for you, and I really believe you're capable of doing it, and I better back out of it. You say it out loud, or say it to yourself. Sometimes we have a need to be the all-powerful, or the all-helpful, or the all-something or other, that somewhere or other along the way, we thought it was indelibly ingrained on us as parents that we can solve all our kids' problems and protect them from all harms and so forth, and then they become 5 or 7 or 14 or whatever their age, various levels where I want to do it myself comes in. And we all of a sudden say, but no one needs me. What am I going to do now? Perhaps it might have been helpful back at an earlier part to say, well, this is some way that you can begin to solve some of your own problems. But not to just back out and say, that's your problem, I'm not going to deal with it, don't talk to me about it. And that's negative.
I found the one explanation that mine accepted, but oh mother, I am such and such years old, I can, you know, I can do it on my own. And I said, well, I'm sorry, I guess it's the mother instinct in me. All through your younger years, I have, you know, tried to guide you along. And as you get older and start making decisions for yourself, it's hard for a mother to reverse herself and learn all over again not to do these things and let them loosen. They kind of understood that a little. Maybe they did. It seemed to me they did.
And then as you say it to yourself, are you saying, Gina, what ways can I gradually say, what are your possibilities? You tell me what the possibilities are, as a kind of saying, I know you're capable, I'll listen.
I think it's harder with the oldest one.
Mm-hmm.
Because,
first one to let go.
Right, because you have really wanted to do your best with that one from the very beginning, and you've learned that maybe you put too many pressures in certain areas that you didn't have to.
And you say to yourself, oh, just one more chance.
Uh-huh.
Just two more chances.
Right, and you have to retrain yourself to back off and think before you say something. And you know, right away, when they're little, you make their decisions. And as they grow older, they have to keep making a few more for themselves. And so we as parents have to retrain ourselves to try to
gradually pull back
without, you know, saying, well, you know, every decision that they make is right, or every decision that we make is right or wrong. And we just have to kind of give and take as you go along, and they seem to accept that. I don't know.
It's handy if you have a kind of shorthand version within your family of reminding the other person where you're at, or saying, that's really my problem, I just need you to listen.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you really own that problem, what are your feelings? Or, you know, that, however you might do it.
And don't be afraid to say that you you might have been wrong. That's the one thing we fail as parents, is we're always right and you're always wrong as far as the kids are concerned. That's a mistake we make, and that they're not always wrong, and we're not always right.
Hear that, kids?
And we look back. I mean, we're all human beings,
mm-hmm.
and all of us, whether from one age to death, none of us are perfect, and we know that. And we can't say, well, because I'm your parent, I know best. We don't always know best, because as the kids get older, they become more knowledgeable and broaden their thinking, and sometimes their ideas are a little better in certain ways.
And because they have another set of ears and another
right.
mind that adds additional thinking and hearing
right.
into the situation that we may not be aware of, and that could be very important.
But we must be open, both of us, to listening to both sides and then thinking it out and making a good decision, not because it's my decision or your decision, but because it's the right thing. Of course, then they ask, well, what is the right thing? Then you have to go back, well, what God wants us to do.
How can we accept, love, and forgive each other?